I'm very convinced that being hit in the head by a baseball bat when I was 6 years old propelled me into the theater.
Bartlett Scheer, the Tony Award-winning theater director, isn't being tongue-in-cheek here. He's not making some joke about how nuts you have to be to go into theater. No, he means it literally.
Just because it put me in this very different place. It put me outside of the regular kids. I had to go through a couple of brain surgeries to sort of clear out all the bone chips in my brain. I think it sort of reshaped my way of seeing things. Then later, when I was in sixth grade, so a bit older, I broke my leg, my femur, and I spent 3 months in the hospital. And while I was in the hospital, you know, just in traction, I was perfectly fine. I did all kinds of crazy, adventurous things that were unusual. So I always felt, and I think theater people in general, are a little bit outsiders. And I always felt a little bit on the edge and a little bit on the outside. So that those kind of experiences were quite formative to me. And they did lead me to be interested in expressive experiences and perspectives. And I was always very questioning and very both sensitive and questioning at the same time.
Risk-taking also?
Risk-taking, yeah. I mean, as a kid, I did all kinds of crazy sports and did all that stuff. So, yeah, I like risk. I don't seek danger. I don't get a thrill out of risk. I'm just unafraid of risk. You know, I don't think there's anything scarier than putting on a new musical on Broadway. And for anybody who wants to take a big risk, you should try and do that, because that is about as scary as it gets.
Bartlett Scheer has directed many a Broadway show, including the 2008 revival of South Pacific, which won him the Tony. As I record this episode, his revival of My Fair Lady is about to begin previews at New York's Lincoln Center Theater, where he's the resident director. But here's the thing. Whether or not you get to see his shows in New York or as they tour, listening to Bartlett Scheer talk about his work will make you think differently about theater and about what it means to live a creative life. This is What It Takes, a podcast about passion, vision, and perseverance from the Academy of Achievement. I'm Alice Winkler.
Adam A., this child is gifted. And I heard that enough that I started to believe it.
If you have the opportunity, not a perfect opportunity, and you don't take it, you may never have another chance.
It all was so clear. It was just like the picture started to form itself.
There was no way in which a lie could prevail over the truth. Darkness over light, death over life.
Every day I wake up and decide, today I'm going to love my life. Decide.
My advice is, if they're going to break your leg once when you go in that place, stay out of there.
And then along come these differential experiences that you don't look for, you don't plan for. But boy, you better not miss them.
Think about this. When you go to the theater, when you choose to walk into a public space, a few things happen. You are forcibly cut off from your electronics and separated from your silo of information, your personally chosen perspective. And you choose to be in a room in this ancient ritual that we have called theater with other people whom you don't know and who probably don't share your view of the world. And together you engage with a story that you may know nothing about.
Bartlett, or Bart Scheer, thinks a lot about what it means to go see live theater. He spoke about it eloquently during the Academy of Achievement Summit in London in the fall of 2017. He was in London because he was directing Oslo, a play he first directed on Broadway. You'll hear more about that work and another excerpt of his speech in a bit. But Scheer also sat down for a conversation with interviewer Gail Eichenthal for the Academy, and they began by talking about how Scheer got into theater in the first place. He traced it, of course, to those terrible physical traumas he suffered, but also to growing up in a family of seven kids in San Francisco in the middle of the political and social ferment of the 1960s and 70s.
Things were changing and transforming. I had many older brothers. So I remember sitting in with my brothers in the living room and their friends as they watched the lottery for who was going to go to Vietnam. And watching these kids see whether their birthday would come up in high in the lottery or low. and feel the risk of that and wonder what the world was, what that meant in the world, and saw actively people taking enormous risks politically, taking lots of drugs, the explosion of what was then the hippie culture in San Francisco. My brothers were into the Grateful Dead, so they took me to concerts when I was very young, which also was highly formative in my theater experience. So I grew up in a really transformative, chaotic, not safe environment in terms of what the city was like. But it was also social and political, and people were taking risks of every kind, and you felt the culture transforming.
And there was a tumult in your own family.
Yeah, my parents were divorcing, so we were all kind of on our own. And with seven kids, my mother had polio in one arm, and then she remarried a Chinese Hawaiian from, who'd been born in Macau. And so I suddenly had this sort of mixed race family, extended family. So the world was quite complicated, but also quite thrilling and quite full of, I really felt like it was way early to where we see mixed families and different kinds of ways of seeing the world were opening up then in a very powerful way.
So how did the dots connect for Bartlett Scheer between all that was going on in his life and the life of the country and theater?
I think a lot of people go into theater as an escape, or they look for a second family. I don't really know if that was what I did it for. I like expression. I like stories. I like creating stories and making stories, and I like responding to the world I'm in. So I don't think I'm very personal in my work. Like, I think I'm an interpretive artist, not a creative artist. So I start with something that's already there, and I interpret it.
In his view, a creative artist is a writer or a painter, for example, inventing new worlds out of whole cloth, whereas his task as an interpreter begins with a text or a score that's handed to him. And he takes it from there, building what he called in his speech make-believe machines, made mostly of words and music, in windowless rooms under artificial light, surrounded by wigs and costumes.
This work of the interpretive artist, this job I've had for some 30 years now, has come to be more and more important to me, and actually more confounding. Because as I try to get better in my work in the theater, I find I am more confused than ever at the job of interpreting the reality of my life as a citizen, and my ability to trust basic assumptions about the world around me. I do something else that is strange. I do all my work in public. I shape and develop and preview, as we call it in the theater, my work in large rooms before total strangers. I take these pre-existing realities in the form of plays and musicals and operas, and I do my work and edit changes and shape the experience basically in the presence of an audience. And believe me, they can be quite strong-minded, especially in New York. I'm in a constant conversation with audience, and in a way, we do it together.
Bart Scheer may assert that what he brings to his business as a storyteller in collaboration with the audience isn't personal, but interpretive artists have a way of bringing their own experiences to their work all the same. That was certainly the case when he directed the 2008 revival of South Pacific on Broadway, the Rodgers and Hammerstein musical about racial prejudice based on a novel by James Michener. And as an aside, we have a James Michener episode of What It Takes where he tells fascinating stories about writing that book, episode number 10, so don't miss that. But back to Bartlett Scheer talking about the musical.
The basic subject of South Pacific, as we used to analyze it, or as I looked at it, was who gets to be in our family. Because at the end of the play, Nellie Forbush, played by Kelly O'Hara beautifully for me, goes from being somebody who essentially is a racist, grew up in a very racist sort of background. She shares the values of the community she grew up in. She meets Emile Debeck, and he's got these mixed race kids, and she has to change who she is and learn to be a different person and accept how big her family, what her family could be. Now, this was important for the country in, you know, following World War II, to like who was going to be in our family in the beginning of questions of race in America. But it was also important when we were doing it in 2008, because we were looking at questions of gay marriage and how families were again changing. And I grew up in a family that changed, that went from, you know, being a sort of white middle-class family in San Francisco to including a whole Asian family of that became a part of our lives. And we didn't have any big questions about it. So I will say that South Pacific felt very personal to me in that way. Very, very poignant because of my stepfather who was Chinese Hawaiian, because I could see that who gets to be in our family meant a lot, means a lot.
You've got to be taught to hate and fear. You've got to be taught from year to year. It's got to be drummed in your dear little ear. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be taught to be afraid of people whose eyes are oddly made and people whose skin is a different shade. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be taught before it's too late, before you are 6 or 7 or 8, to hate all the people your relatives hate. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be carefully taught.
We did a lot of research on the piece about segregation in the military, because Nimitz at the time had been ordered by FDR to desegregate the Navy, and he refused. So interesting when you think now what that would feel like. And in fact, so we kept them segregated on stage. We had, had to find a group of African-American CBs, and the struggles that they went through to serve our military were very profound. And you wanted audiences to have an experience of what that was like so that they could see, you know, what those difference, what that world was like that people grew up in.
It was the first revival since the original production in 1949, which is incredible because the music was instant classic.
Yeah.
That must have been quite a lot of pressure for you.
Yeah, that's a bit lot of pressure. But again, I like the pressure. I think what we felt at the time, my collaborators and myself and Lincoln Center, was that when you do something like that, you have to give people a very deep memory of South Pacific. They'd listened to it, they'd seen it when they were young. We had people come first preview who were from military families who'd seen the original production.
And the movie too.
And the movie. And they had to have an experience of it that reminded them of why they loved it as when they originally saw it. But at the same time, we had a responsibility to understand its immediate significance now. So we were in a balancing act between providing, you know, that sound of the music, an orchestra that plays it as they would have originally heard it, plus pushing it into the questions we're asking ourselves now as a country. And those are the kinds of things I love to do as an interpretive artist, is find myself in that balancing act between then and now, and taking classics or taking even new works and asking questions about who I am as a citizen, a parent, a partner, a part of the world inside of the piece, and finding how it affects us right now in the culture we're living in.
Bartlett Scheer took more than 10 months to cast South Pacific. His process is unusual, painstaking, and legendary. For the role of Emile Debeck, he cast someone unknown to theatergoers, Paulo Schott, a Brazilian opera singer with some Polish ancestry.
Some enchanted evening, you may see a stranger. You may see a stranger across a crowded room.
But the big, perfect singing voice was not the only thing Bart Scheer was after. When he auditions actors, he's looking for something that he calls pearly mist, a kind of luminous charisma, and Paulo Schott had it, as well as the big, beautiful voice and an authentic otherness necessary for the character. No matter that Schott had never actually spoken a line of dialogue on stage before. For the part of Nellie Forbish, Scheer cast another actor with a singing voice that could melt armor and more than enough pearly mist to spare, Kelly O'Hara.
When the sky is a bright canary yellow, I forget every cloud I've ever seen. So they call me a cockeyed optimist, immature and incurably green.
This was her second time directed by Bart Scheer. The first was during the production of The Light in the Piazza. Ms. O'Hara also attended the Academy of Achievement Summit in 2017, and she told Gail Eichenthal what it's like to work under Bart Scheer.
I think that he calls the audience the final collaborator. He knows that we work hard, we research. I mean, he goes more thoroughly into something than anybody I've ever known. And we put all that time into it, but we cannot know what our impact is until there's someone receiving it. And with the reception is the giving and the back and forth and the play. And that is what's so beautiful. Someone said one time, I want to go out there and I just want to sing the way I want to sing. And that's all that matters to me. And I realized right there in that moment, that is not at all how I think about performing. And I think he's the same way. In fact, if you're working in a room with him, he'll constantly turn back and say, feedback, like, tell me what you think, give me something. And that's how I feel. Are you feeling something? Is this working? And some artists might say, well, you can't rely on that. But yes, you can. Because if the feedback is not good, go deeper, go harder. I love that give and take. I don't want to worry about give and take from strangers via social media or words that people just spout. I want to be in a room with somebody and see a reaction. I love that. It's so fulfilling.
You've said about him that he can be tough because he demands a lot, and that he almost requires an interactive kind of relationship, even in rehearsal, where he's the director, but he wants you to put stuff out there too.
Yes, Bart is never going to. The kind of preparation some directors do is to set up the world and then you're going to step here and you're going to walk there and the light's going to do that. Bart thinks about the history, the time period, what was going on at that time, the emotional effects of everything around the people involved in the story, and then he'll build the world. But then he has to bring you into the knowledge of that world because you're the person within that world. You're going to be portraying the person within that world. He can't do that for you, and he knows that. So if you're not coming to the table with opinions or knowledge or feelings about how a person would have reacted in a certain time, because he's only one person, and he knows that, although he's knowledgeable about the human condition more than anybody I know. It's funny, he could tell me more about my father than I probably could, you know, and he doesn't know my father that well. I mean, he's met him for many times, but he's the kind of person who just understands the human condition, but he can't put it inside you. So it's your job. He doesn't do your job for you. And if you don't come to the table, then he doesn't have time for it. Because he already knows what it should be, but he can't place it on you. You have to know it yourself. So he expects his actors to do their work, to do their job.
He said in our interview that it's never, quote, right, unquote. It has to constantly be evolving.
Hmm. Yes. In fact, if you'll see him right before a preview period or right before the critics come or whatever, if he seems calm or if he seems that like everything is okay, then there's a problem. He's never satisfied. And I think, you know, we as actors learn that the hard way. You think you open something up and then you just run it. The most amazing thing with being forced to do a show. Now, see, I say that because it seems like a dream to get to do a show. The dream is to do the show. The job is to continue to do the show.
Kelly O'Hara played Ensign Nellie Forbish for almost 2 years. 8 shows a week. The then New York Times reviewer, Charles Isherwood, was downright euphoric when he wrote about her performance. Quote, she sings with a radiance that is the sound of hope and happiness made manifest in a voice that could melt the heart of the most unregenerate musical hater. Unquote. But the foundations for that radiance under Bartlett Scheer's direction were deep research and emotional excavation.
That was an incredibly educational time. We had war veterans, World War II war veterans, a lot of men and women who were really honestly at the end of their lives, coming and reliving some of these things for us. And that's who our audience was in large part, which was just, it was the heaviest thing you can imagine, trying to respect their time. I think that Bart, you think of, people think of South Pacific and they think Honey Bun, and they think of these, I'm going to wash that man. He had this intention at that moment in 2008. We had a very interesting presidential campaign going on. We had Barack Obama running for president. And in our story, we had the most incredible story of race, racist issues. And I am the vessel. I get it. I understand. I'm blonde, I'm white. And I took that on with a lot of pride because I wanted to show the idea that there can be change. But what was interesting about it was that this was the show came out in 49. I believe we were supposed to be in 42. That was how it was then. And you realize in 2008, how have we come anywhere? Yes, we have, but how much farther do we have to go? And there was this great depth and kind of weight to it when we were in the room researching. He segregated our cast. And we had one boy from one amazing dancer from Arkansas who kind of went with it. And then we had a couple of others from art schools in you know, the Lower East Side, New York, who were like, this is very uncomfortable for me. I've never felt anything like this in my life. But you had the young man from Arkansas who was like, you know, I get it. You had these things going on in the room, and there was discomfort because Bart said, this is what we're going to tell. We're not going to change because we're going to tell the story that needs to be told. And, you know, I can't speak for every audience member, but I think it was so relevant in a way. It made us feel like we were doing something right as far as reopening that a little bit and making another point about it. You know, there were a lot of actually lyrics and lines changed in the original version because just the world wasn't ready for it, that Bart put back in. Some from James Michener from the novel and some, you know, from the original libretto. So it was a very interesting time and I learned a lot.
Isn't it a little bit scary to have a revival of such a classic work?
It is, but I have full trust doing it with Bart, because Bart also doesn't really necessarily go and pay a lot of attention to the original versions. You really kind of look at a piece of material and you're either driven to be excited about an idea that makes it relevant right now, or you don't do it.
You know, my mother says we have nothing in common, but she's wrong. We have something very important in common.
Yes, we are both in love.
Yes, but more than that, we're the same kind of people fundamentally, you and me. We appreciate things. We're not blasé, you know what I mean? I hear the human race is falling on its face.
Was Kelly O'Hara in your mind as you took this on?
Not quite originally, actually. I mean, I had just done Light in the Piazza with her, and she'd gone off to have success in other shows. But she actually had to come in an audition, which I don't think she enjoyed very much. But it became very clear when she and Paolo read together that you had something special. That special chemistry you don't always expect, that became very palpable in the room with the two of them, and that's something that's very rare.
But I'm stuck like a dope with a thing called hope, and I can't get it out of my heart. What is
heart? People don't realize when you're casting, they think, oh, you know, there's so many talented people, it'll be great. But when we talk about the people that you really need to be as good as Kelly O'Hara, you can see literally thousands and thousands of people. And when you get down to the end, it's the last 2 to 1% at the very top who have all the skills at all the level that you're talking about that are incredibly unique. And I think people believe, of course, that isn't the case, but it is. And you have to hunt and search and look and hope that you find people that are going to move up to the standard that you hope for.
Once the process moves from the audition to the stage, Bart Scheer is equally demanding, but he also has a reputation as a caregiver.
Yeah. I mean, I think my reputation is for being very honest. Like, I think what actors appreciate is to be told the truth. So what that means is you want them to hear the truth in the room when they can. So that means, for me, that means when something's, as they're in the middle of their process and you're working on something, evaluate it very clearly for them right away. Because if you can be very, very specific with them right away, it makes a huge difference in their own ability to chart where they are in the work. So I can be blunt, I can be precise, but I've always found that actors appreciate it. Because often you're sort of waiting and you can play the kind of passive-aggressive game of hoping they find their way there, and I'm not very good at that.
And you want it to get right sooner than later?
No, not get right. I want it to keep growing. You want it to keep moving along. Getting right is not, solving it is not necessarily it. In fact, if it keeps changing, I'm fine. It's when it stops changing that I get nervous. You know, you want it to keep evolving. You want to be building a conversation with your actors and artists, which keeps the thing moving forward. It's when you get stuck or when you can't move forward that you end up in trouble.
So you've said that the messiness of that process isn't that problematic for you. You almost welcome it.
No, I inspire it. I create a certain amount of, it's a conversation, it's a verb, it's a becoming, it's not a thing. We're not heading for a place. We're heading for a conversation which is unfolding all the time, in which the actors are constantly in a dialectic process with me about what this thing is we're making. And I build and lead a conversation toward what the work is.
In other words, he doesn't dictate the end result, because in fact, he doesn't have it all worked out in his head ahead of time. And as Kelly O'Hara noted, that dialectic, that ongoing collaboration continues even after the production opens.
You know, we have long processes, right? So if you take a 5-week rehearsal period, 2 weeks of tech, 5 weeks of previews, the preview period is quite interesting because you're performing at night and you're correcting during the day. So you work in front of people and you're making adjustments. In that tuning, you really hone it down to a very precise machine, as it were. What's important for the run, there's a couple things, is you have to have enough life and enough integrity on the part of the performers that they're challenging themselves to keep listening and to keep, they know where the points are they have to hit, but they have to keep exploring the text all the time. I don't think people realize, if you do these shows 8 times a week, how difficult it is to bring something, bring that back each time and to keep that freshness alive. So we have what's called maintenance, where we, you know, I'll go in or my associate will go in every week or couple of weeks and give them a set of notes and keep them on the work, because it can get tiring. And long runs for musicals are very draining. It's a job. And so that part becomes interesting and challenging for good performers. Someone like Kelly is just a war horse in terms of how, a warrior with how long she can sustain and support a profound performance for 8 shows a week for a year. It's quite incredible.
There are a couple of things that make a musical sustainable for the performers, and they are the same things, the very difficult things, that make a musical good in the first place.
One is you have to have a good idea to start with, right? So you have to pick a good subject to make a musical about. And that means the subject has to have good reasons to sing, certain qualities that go into what makes it a musical. So if you take an obvious example, Hamilton is not only a great musical, but it's a great idea for a musical. Maybe one of the greatest ideas for a musical, to take those subjects and put them together. Adam had an intuition about Light in the Piazza, this story of a young girl and her mom in Italy, that there was a sound there, the sort of sound of falling in love, the longing there.
Adam is Adam Gettel, who wrote the music and the lyrics, and is also, by the way, Richard Rodgers' grandson.
And he could build a score with this extraordinary thing. And Craig Lucas, who wrote maybe one of the best books that's been written for a musical in 25 years, match that together, because also what's true about a musical is the book writing is very hard, because it has to be a platform for the singing, and it has to string together all these ideas. And it was just a perfect match. It took a long time to develop, but it was a perfect match. But mostly because of Adam, and mostly because even when we did it the first time in Seattle, it just happened to have the best cast people now who are so well known in the musical theater world. Vicki Clark, Celia Keenan-Bolger, Kelly O'Hara, Steve Pasquale. These are extraordinary people, all in some small theater in Seattle, more or less at the beginning or middle of their careers, making something extraordinary with maybe our best composer. So we were very lucky in all of those elements. It was a very extraordinary collaboration. So you could have all those elements all at the same time. And when that kind of kismet, that kind of luck kind of swirls around a piece, very incredible things happen. So it was unlike anything you could have ever seen in a musical before. I could only compare it to something like Hamilton. It's more traditional than Hamilton, but it had that deep an impact. It was so special as a musical.
I'm just a someone in an old museum, far away from home as someone can go. And the beauty is I still meet people I know. Hello! This is wanting something. This is reaching for. This is wishing that a moment would arrive. This is taking chances. This is almost touching what the beauty is.
You mentioned the phrase, a reason to sing.
Yeah.
The idea that a song has to come from somewhere.
You get, this really starts if you go back to Shakespeare, because you have the shift in Shakespeare between prose and poetry. And when is it appropriate for someone to speak in prose, and when do they lift into verse? And verse is an elevated form of speech. This grew, you know, as we understand it, into forms like opera, where the speech was so elevated it could only be sung. And the subjects for that have to be very intense, where singing is the only really possible place that can express it. And in something like Piazza, where Margaret Johnson and Victoria Clark together come to sing this song Fable, which has the hugest expression of letting go of her daughter and changing it, that is better expressed through music. And music is the step up from everything else. And the musical's a weird form of that, because it traffics between prose and verse, between the ordinary speech and the elevated speech. And when they lift into song, the expression has to be incapable of being expressed any other way. And that's what makes it so unique.
For the joy that you thought you'd never know, for here at last away you go to a man who looks for you. He'll find in the wide, wide world, that someone sees, that someone knows you.
Fiddler on the Roof, there was a connection, I gather, to your Lithuanian Jewish father,
yeah,
who you didn't know was Jewish.
Yeah, no, I grew up in a Catholic household. I went to Catholic schools all my life, all the way through college. When my parents divorced and my father moved away, my mother said to me when I was like 13, oh, by the way, your father's Jewish. Your grandmother, who has that accent, we've always told you was Lithuanian, is actually Jewish. Both of my grandparents were very fluent Yiddish speakers. My grandmother, who was a very extraordinary woman, spoke 5 languages fluently and never learned to read or write. She was very much of the old country. And that discovery was kind of like, I was thrilled. I thought it was great. I thought it was a whole new thing I could discover about myself. And it always was a part of my growing up. I think my wife says I'm the only Jew in my family. because I went into the arts or because of whatever the reasons are. And when I took on Fiddler, I took it on specifically because of my father, who was born in Lithuania, and because of my grandmother, because I wanted to explore what their lives were like. I wanted to do the research and see what it was like to go through that. And that was, again, very personal.
There's another example of having a classic musical that puts a lot of pressure on the director.
It does, but it's another example of a classic musical that's an unexpected, excellent idea for a musical. No one expected when Fiddler happened that you could make a musical out of such a thing. You know, and when Sheldon Harnick and Jerry Bock and Joe Stein, who's a great book writer, pulled together this story from these things with Jerome Robbins' help, they did an extraordinary thing. And they took a very complex subject, which was serious and funny and light, but powerful, and they melded all that together. And music was a good vehicle for that.
Reading about your technique and process as a director reminded me of what I've read about Jerome Robbins, in that he was apparently quite a perfectionist, quite a stickler for making it right. And reading about Fiddler on the Roof and Barbara Eisenberg's book, my goodness, I mean, he practically tortured those people.
The famous story where he said, you know, what is this play? What is this about? What is this about? And somebody, I think might have been Sheldon Harnick, said, it's about tradition. And he said, great, it's about tradition. Write that song for me.
Who day and night must scramble for a living, feed a wife and children, say his daily prayers, and who has the right, as master of the house, to have the final word at home? The papa!
Bartlett Shear's Fiddler was staged in 2015, and the response was overwhelming. He made one small change to the frame of the story that had a huge impact. It encouraged audiences to draw a connection between what happened to the Jews of Anatevka, the fictional shtetl of the play, and the real-life modern refugee crisis happening around the world. Bart Shear has been the force behind other wonderful musical revivals, too. But he also has a large body of work in opera. In fact, just a few days after My Fair Lady opens in April 2018, he's directing the Metropolitan Opera's production of Romeo and Juliet at Lincoln Center.
Opera is what they call the great tradition. It demands the most of you. The conditions are very difficult. You don't have a lot of time. You have to work fast. You don't get the singers for as long as you'd like. And especially with the great well-known operas like Otello or Barbara Seville, you have to really do your homework about why you're doing the opera and make very profound decisions, because audiences know these pieces and they want you to take them somewhere they've not been. And that challenge is very intense.
And then, in addition to the musicals and the operas, there are the plays. As I mentioned near the beginning of this episode, when Bartlett Shear was in London for the Academy of Achievement Summit in the fall of 2017, his production of Oslo was playing just a few blocks away on the West End. The play tells the story of the 1993 Middle East Peace Agreement and was written by J.T. Rogers. When Shear directed the play in New York, it won the Tony for Best Play and pretty much every other theater prize possible. Bartlett Shear says he loves doing political plays because theater is a wonderful place to experience the wide scope of ideas.
JT is a writer that I've worked with on two plays now, and we're working on more coming up. And Oslo, we had always wanted to do something about a subject as difficult as the struggle between the Palestinians and the Israelis. And Oslo came into our lives in a weird way. My oldest daughter's best friend in second grade was named Emma Rod Larsen. She was the daughter of two extremely famous Norwegian diplomats. And I met them and got to know them, and we became close friends, and would go to soccer matches to watch our daughters play. And Taya would tell extraordinary stories of Middle East peace. And we invited him to speak to our cast of Blood and Gifts, a play I'd previously done with JT. And his stories were so incredible that I suggested to JT he should go out and have a longer conversation with with Taya, and he came back and said, I think we have a play here, and began developing that. It's a history play. It's an old-fashioned Shakespearean form of history play. It deals with very specific events, and it's also what we call a bit of an intellectual thriller. And that allows audiences to learn new things and to see very complicated dynamics worked out.
Yeah, it's such a high-profile event, the Peace Accords, but probably very few people knew about the back-channel negotiations.
Yeah, which is why people do them. It's an extraordinary thing. It had all the ingredients for great... The thing that's hardest about the Palestinians and Israelis is how do you tell the story from a neutral point of view? And the presence of the Norwegians meant we had a neutral proxy for our audience. And the fact that they had a back channel meant that there were secret conversations going on, which were small in number, which were very volatile, and which could be dramatized in a way which could be quite profound and quite fun. So that had all the elements for making a great piece of theater.
You won Best Play.
It did.
Were you surprised by its popularity?
It's very weird because from the beginning, when we started in the small theater at Lincoln Center, it was a play that we didn't really know how people would receive it. And we actually were sold out almost before we started. People wanted to have a conversation about this. They wanted to come in and be able to have an entertainment and a political conversation at the same time. And it's also a play that's changed since we've done it, because events around it have changed so intensely. So it went from being a play about Palestinians and Israelis when we first did it to, following the election in America, it became a play about Democrats and Republicans and being implacable enemies that, you know, couldn't figure out a way. And then by the time we got here to London, it became a play about Brexit and about how do you negotiate your future. So it's complicated and interesting, and it's been fascinating to watch how history has bounced. A very specific time in history is giving us information about where we are now.
There are also plans for Oslo to become a movie with Bart Scheer as the director. It will be his first film. But meanwhile, he says, his dedication to theater, whether drama or musical, has only deepened as he has watched the United States become increasingly polarized. Polarized to the point where we are watching the same events and coming to completely opposite conclusions.
Well, I think it's becoming more and more important, live theater, than it ever was. One of my worries as a person, living in the 21st century is that people's information becomes more and more... You can tailor make your own information. You can silo what you want to believe. You can choose what you want to follow. You can follow only your websites. You can get your information from your news station. You can do all the things you want to do for yourself. As opposed to when you go to the theater, you have to sit in a room with strangers, and they may not agree with your point of view. They may not know it. You have to participate in something and share an experience in a live community setting. You have to turn your phone off. You have to be present in an experience which is very unique and growing more and more unique. Now, it's an entertainment. It's a leaving your house. It's going somewhere. But it's actually one of the last things left of an ancient world that we still participate in. And it's kind of required to allowing us to experience strong ideas, poetry, transformation with others, not by yourself. And not where you get to decide, I'm going to watch these TV shows on these networks and all that. You actually have to go and be a part of a larger conversation.
Didn't the Greeks talk about catharsis and terror?
They did, and terror is important. You need to scare the crap out of people. When you scare them, or when you get them in a state of complexity or tragic response, they are lifted out of themselves. They are placed in a new context where they can shape and experience poetry, experience loss, process the problems of loss. And that's important, experience of theater. You go to study your history, to see other people go through tragic, complex events, to see them laugh, and you transfer into that experience and you ask questions exactly what that means now. And I think it's critical to being human to be able to participate in that and to do it in a room with other people where you can share that experience.
That's Tony Award-winning director Bartlett Scheer in conversation with Gail Eichenthal for the Academy of Achievement. Earlier, we also heard from actress and singer extraordinaire, also a Tony Award winner, Kelly O'Hara. You can find out about lots of extraordinary leaders and innovators who are members of the Academy at achievement.org. Inspiration guaranteed. This is What It Takes from the Academy of Achievement. I'm Alice Winkler.
I could have spread my wings and done a thousand things I've never done before. I'll never know what made it so exciting.
What It Takes is generously funded by the Catherine B. Reynolds Foundation. Thanks to them, and thanks to you for listening.